There is another world. Beautiful heritage of what was called in old times internationalism.
And I think reclaiming thinking has to be part of our new revolution.
I am resistance.
If we learn to wield those weapons of truth and justice, I still remain totally, completely confident that we can yet win.
Tune in to hear more of these voices for change, of dissent, in essence. Visionary Voices, here, starting on Monday, July 24th, on your listener-sponsored radio, 94.1 KPFA.
KPFA's Summer Mini Fund Drive begins Monday, July 24th. Log on to kpfa.org/volunteer for details. And today is a spare the day. Spare the Air Day. Ride public transit throughout the Bay Area for free until 12 midnight tonight. Log on to 511.org or call toll free 511 for more information. You are listening to KPFA or KPFB in Berkeley, KFCF in Fresno, and online at kpfa.org. The time is 1 minute past 6 p.m. Stay tuned for the KPFA evening news.
Good evening. It's Friday, July 21st, 2006. 10 days into the Israeli assault on Lebanon, Israel poises itself to escalate its military operations there. As many as 6,000 Israeli troops are massed along Israel's border with Lebanon, and there are conflicting reports over whether Israel will or won't launch a full-scale invasion that Lebanese residents fear could flatten their country, where nearly 350 people have died already. In the Bay Area, dozens rallied in the Peninsula and South Bay against Israel's operations in Lebanon in two demonstrations this afternoon. Israel's assault on Gaza and the West Bank continues. Today, the Israeli army killed a nurse who was aiding Palestinian civilians wounded by Israeli tank shells. The day after the Iraq government announces more than 160,000 Iraqis have fled their homes to escape violent attacks there, Democratic lawmakers in the United States make a push for new debate on the U.S. occupation of Iraq. A San Francisco independent journalist is under pressure from a federal grand jury to hand over video of a protest last year during which a San Francisco police car was allegedly burned. An animal rights activist told a national call-in day to pressure Andronico's market to contract with more humane egg producers. This is the KPFA Evening News with Glenn Reeder. I'm Sandra Lupien. Israel called up thousands of reservist soldiers today, massing as many as 6,000 troops along its border with Israel. There are conflicting reports over whether Israel plans a full-scale invasion of Lebanon. Most recently, Reuters reported a military source ruling out a mass invasion of southern Lebanon, but the source reportedly said the army would increase the intensity of a 10-day-old military assault on Lebanon, which Israel says is aimed at freeing two soldiers captured by the Lebanese resistance group Hezbollah. Earlier, CNBC, an NBC News affiliate, reported that Israeli intelligence sources told NBC that an Israeli invasion of Lebanon is likely tonight. CNBC also reported that an unidentified Western nation told NBC that Israeli troops were expected to enter Lebanon tonight. A source later reported that Israel had ruled out a full-scale invasion. Israeli spokesperson Mark Regev, asked on CNN about reports of an imminent Israeli ground attack on Lebanon, said, quote, "I can say the following, you have a threat there and we have to deal with the threat." A full-scale invasion would escalate further what has been a growing crisis in Lebanon. Israel has killed nearly 350 Lebanese people, almost all of them civilians, in its 10-day assault. Just over 30 Israelis have died in fighting and by rocket attacks reportedly launched by the Lebanese resistance group Hezbollah. About half of the Israelis killed have been civilians. Israel launched its assault after Hezbollah captured two Israeli soldiers in fighting that broke out on the Israeli-Lebanon border on July 10th. The circumstances around the fighting were not clear. Thousands of Lebanese civilians fled north after they earlier dropped flyers on border villages telling civilians to leave the area. Those who remained in their villages and those throughout Lebanon braced for stepped-up Israeli assaults. Andrea Buffa reports.
Throughout the day, media outlets have been reporting on Israeli tanks and troops amassing on the border of Lebanon. The possibility of a full-scale invasion by Israel has captured the attention of the world. No one is more attuned to the crisis than people living in Lebanon and their friends and family members abroad. Rita Hamad, a Lebanese-American medical student at University of California, San Francisco, has family members throughout Lebanon and tries to talk with them once a day.
Things have been pretty terrible for them. Several of the areas where they live have been flyered and leafleted by the IDF, telling them that they should evacuate. And then the irony is that the roads that they're supposed to evacuate on have either already been bombed or are actively being bombed during the evacuation. And actually, one of my aunts, when she was on her way from South Lebanon to Beirut, she says that a missile hit the car directly behind her, I'm assuming killing its inhabitants.
Her aunt, Rita Hajj Ali, is a teacher and mother of two in Beirut. Her husband and children have been in southern Lebanon.
During the last 10 days, my children were in the south, and as I told you, bombs were falling all over in the south. People killed, children mutilated, whole families with their houses collapsing on them, with the pretext that there are arms in their houses and explosives, which I don't think is true. Nobody in the right mind, Lebanese people in the right mind, civilians, would have arms in their house or explosives. So many kids died. Maybe from the 350 or 380 civilians who died in Lebanon, maybe 250 are just kids under 15 or under 14 years old.
Southern Lebanon has been hardest hit during the current crisis and would be most affected in the case of an invasion by Israel. But all of Lebanon is in turmoil. Rania Masri is an Arab-American writer and professor who lives in northern Lebanon.
In the north here, the north is flooded with refugees escaping from the terror in the south and in Beirut and in Baalbek. There isn't one area in Lebanon that hasn't suffered in one way, either through bombardment or either through the flood of refugees that have come. We have 500,000 internally displaced Lebanese, 130,000 Lebanese that have left the country. This is not including the Lebanese with dual citizenships that have been evacuated as foreign nationals.
There is also a humanitarian crisis. Rami El Amin is a member of Sustain, Stop U.S. Tax-Funded Aid to Israel Now. He spoke by phone this morning with his brother Bilal, who lives in Beirut.
What's really beginning to materialize now is the humanitarian crisis aspect of it, in the sense that the days of shelling of the bridges and all the infrastructure and the milk factory and the any convoys carrying food, there's the price of food has skyrocketed, something like 500% or something crazy, basically putting it out of the reach of most people.
El Amin is concerned about the possibility of an impending invasion.
It's quite a frightening thought, just because I remember very, clearly the last invasion and occupation. I'm from southern Lebanon. The village we grew up in is what's right on the border of the occupied line, and so it would it basically took a lot of heat.
Rania Masri is also afraid.
And we're frightened that the Israeli army is going to invade and is going to create another occupation zone, as they did in their 1978 and 1982 invasion, in which they then occupied approximately 40% of the Lebanese territory. We've managed to get that down to 20%, but it was still quite extreme. This is our primary worry right now, is that we're going to see our cities and our villages occupied once again.
Lebanese residents and Lebanese Americans both express anger and frustration at the United States government's approval of Israel's actions. Rita Hamad is a UCSF medical student.
I guess my main feeling is one of complete disempowerment, because I look at what's happening in the international community and what's happening in my own government here in the U.S. and what we're doing to help, and basically we're not doing anything. And I feel like anything I try to do, you know, whether it like be write my congressperson or write a letter to the editor, all those normal ways that people sort of try to be active in their government and in their society, all of those are going to be completely ineffectual, because it looks like these are sort of preordained plans that are taking place in the Middle East.
Her aunt in Beirut is more pointed.
And I cannot explain to you how I felt when Condoleezza Rice said somebody asked her something, what are you going to do to the Lebanese people? And she said, I'm praying for the Lebanese people. Thank her very much. She has maybe a temple in her office praying for us. We don't want her prayers. We want a complete ceasefire. And then they can talk and end whatever started this crisis. But they cannot go on slaughtering us like this.
For KPFA News, I'm Andrea Buffa.
The United States has refused to join international ceasefire calls, including one yesterday by United Nations Secretary General Kofi Annan. Instead, the Bush White House, both houses of the U.S. Congress, and U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations John Bolton have made strong public statements of support for Israeli actions and condemnation for Hezbollah and the Palestinian group Hamas. U.S. Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice told a news conference in Washington she would visit the Middle East next week and attend an Italian-hosted international conference in Rome on Wednesday to discuss the issue. Robert Blecher is a fellow at the Center for Human Rights at the University of Iowa and an editor of the Middle East Report. He spoke to KPFA from East Jerusalem, where he emphasized the role of the United States in the current Mideast crisis.
The reason why this has been able to carry on so long and looks like it's going to be able to carry on a little bit longer is because the U.S. has given the green light to Israel to go ahead and do this. And for all the people who are listening, if you want to stop this, you got to get in touch with whatever kind of political activists you can in your area to put pressure on the United States to prevent the further escalation. The Condoleezza Rice is supposed to be coming out here at some point in the future, and the way in which this is configured right now is actually especially dastardly in terms of the delay in her coming, because the delay gives the Israel a green light to act in Lebanon for however much longer. But also there is this idea that she will be coming at a certain point, which means that Israel has to destroy as much of Hezbollah and as much of Lebanon as it will before she actually comes. So it's both a green light to go ahead and act, but in addition to that, there's an extra incentive to be super violent in the short run in order to be able to do as much damage as possible before she gets here.
Lebanese President Emil Ahoud commented on Rice's visit, as well as giving his analysis of Israel's motivation for its assault on Lebanon.
Well, I can tell you it was said 2 days ago she was coming, and she didn't come. Then they said after 2 days. But it's not coming and going that counts. It's the solution that counts. We hope they have a solution for a ceasefire. Ceasefire, and then we talk. It's very disproportionate. Two soldiers has been taken. In the past, there were soldiers taken, and they exchanged. So now, why they're doing that? Because they have a previous plan, and they're executing that plan, thinking that in that way, they'll do what they did in 82. But things have changed since 82, because now it's not like 82. They can come in Lebanon and make a promenade around until they reach Beirut. No, these people on the ground, Lebanese, are ready to die for their land. Not only Hezbollah, many Lebanese are ready to die for their land.
Lebanese President Emil Lahoud spoke today on CNN. With more analysis from Lebanon, Free Speech Radio News reporter Jackson Allers.
Roads to the northern part of Lebanon were clogged with families and overloaded vehicles attempting to flee the south amid rumors of a larger Israeli military offensive to be conducted in the coming days. The government says that about 500,000 Lebanese have been displaced and more refugees are expected. And as the Lebanese government attempts to avert a humanitarian crisis, a growing chorus of Lebanese voices is stepping forward to criticize the U.S. response to the widening conflict in Lebanon. Lebanese Minister of Culture Tariq Mitri said in a press conference today that Lebanon was suffering under the weight of the massive 10-day Israeli military campaign. Despite the contact the Lebanese government had with the U.S., Mitri hinted that a ceasefire was a long way off.
Until now, we have not heard from the United States of America a clear position, first on when a ceasefire should be called for, and we think it should be immediate. Obviously, the U.S. position is not the same as ours on this one.
Predictably, there were negative reactions from people on the streets and by Lebanese government officials this week after the Arab press reported that the U.S. Congress voted on Wednesday to back the Israeli military campaigns in both the Gaza Strip and in Lebanon. Former Interior Minister Hassan al-Sabaha spoke to FSRN about what he said was the influence of the Israeli lobby in the United States.
If the Israelis are eloquent and influential in the United States, it doesn't mean that they are on the right side or they are on the right track. They are taking Washington and the United States to nowhere. The right track is to implement UN resolutions.
Lebanese officials have consistently invoked United Nations resolutions in an attempt to bring about a ceasefire. UN Security Council Resolution 1559, passed after the assassination of former Lebanese Prime Minister Rafik Hariri last year, calls on the Lebanese government to disarm Hezbollah. One Hezbollah representative with an American-English accent told FSRN that disarmament was out of the question and that Hezbollah was ready militarily for their last stand against Israel. Meanwhile, official U.S. sources say that U.S. Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice will visit the region next week to help usher in some sort of ceasefire. FSRN asked Omar Nassif, a Hezbollah representative in the Lebanese parliament, about the U.S. response to the conflict and the potential effect of Rice's upcoming visit.
I see there is no chance for Condoleezza Rice to get any profit to get from Hezbollah. This administration and this government are lot of stupid, but I hope so, the American people and the Israeli people will see that later.
Zeina Al-Khalil is a Beirut-based artist helping to coordinate more humanitarian and cultural responses to the conflict. She said that people in the United States and Europe have done little to pressure their governments to stop the conflict because they lack information about the real victims of the violence.
I am sure that if the West really understood what was really happening here, they would condemn Israel's actions right away. Unfortunately, because of the media, what they think right now is that Israel is trying to quote-unquote cleanse Lebanon of some kind of terrorist aggression. And they just leave it at that. People have seen that there are casualties, but they don't realize that most of the casualties so far are women and children.
Lebanese Minister of Cultural Affairs Tariq Mitri confirmed media reports that the majority of civilians killed have been women and children, but was unable to provide any hard statistics. Meanwhile, a Lebanese government official told FSRN today that the Lebanese government had reached an unofficial agreement with Israel to establish humanitarian aid corridors by land and sea to allow the delivery of relief goods. Up to this point, Israel has maintained a strict naval blockade and has failed to give guarantees that convoys carrying relief goods would not be attacked by Israeli warplanes. Reporting from Beirut, this is Jackson Allers for Free Speech Radio News.
As many as 5,000 U.S. citizens were slated to leave Lebanon today, the largest number in one day since the evacuation began Wednesday. U.S. Embassy officials, still smarting from criticism over delays in starting the evacuation effort, said that more than 8,000 of the 25,000 Americans in Lebanon, when the bombing started, will have been evacuated by tonight. This is the KPFA Evening News on 94.1 FM and kpfa.org. Still to come, dozens rally in the Bay Area on the peninsula and South Bay against Israel's operations in Lebanon, Gaza, and the West Bank in two demonstrations this afternoon. And the day after, the Iraq government announces more than 160,000 Iraqis have fled their homes. Democratic lawmakers in the United States make a push for new debate on the U.S. occupation of Iraq. With Glenn Reeder, I'm Sandra Lupien. The Israeli assault in the occupied West Bank and Gaza continues. The military operation is in its fourth week. Today, Israeli soldiers killed a Palestinian nurse and completely destroyed a government security compound in the West Bank city of Nablus. The off-duty nurse had stopped to give medical assistance to three protesters who were wounded by a tank shell. The protesters had reportedly been throwing stones at Israeli soldiers. Palestinian medics said the nurse died from shrapnel wounds suffered when Israeli troops fired a second tank shell. An Israeli army spokesperson said only that troops shot at the demonstrators who threw rocks and petrol bombs at the forces. Israeli forces raided Nablus in the West Bank earlier this week for the first time since launching the assault against Palestinians on June 28th. Its previous ground and air assaults had been limited to the Gaza Strip. At least 100 Palestinians and one Israeli soldiers have died since the assault began. And as Rami Al-Maghari reports from the Mugazi refugee camp in the Gaza Strip, the Israeli military appears to be deploying a new type of weapon.
For the third week in a row, the Israeli forces continue to attack various parts of Gaza Strip. In a new fresh invasion by the Israeli forces of Gaza over the past couple of days, tanks and armored vehicles, backed by warplanes and drones, incurred Wednesday into the central Gaza Strip refugee camp of Maghazi, killing 14 people, wounding about 130 others, and razing vast areas of Palestinian-owned lands. About 30,000 Palestinian residents have been confined to their homes with little water and no electricity, as the Israeli forces had held positions nearby under continued live ammunition, firing on houses and on the street. Raik Al-Khaldi, a 50-year-old retired school teacher and a mother.
I am 50 years old. I have experienced the 1967 catastrophe, the 1973 victory of the Egyptians over the Israelis, but I have never experienced such a disaster. The Jews are just 40 meters away from us. They fire on every object, whether it is a child or a girl or a woman or anything else. They fire on every object, even stones in the trees. They've been slaughtering us. We don't have water or electricity. We are not living as humans. Animals are not living such a life. However, what shall we do? We only ask God to give us patience for such a life.
The Israeli army is using weapons that cause injuries medical personnel have not witnessed before. Dr. Habis Al-Wahidi of Al-Aqsa Martyrs Hospital in central Gaza.
It causes burning to the body of the injured person, to the point that all the...
It causes burning to the body of the injured person, up to the point that all the injured persons were having amputation of the lower limbs. This is a new type that I think is perhaps illegal by international law. Really, we have not been accustomed to such measures because in the first intifada, and even before 5-6 months ago, we did not see such a thing. But nowadays, it has been used, and most of our injured patients have lost their lower limbs.
And most of our injured patients have lost their lower limbs.
Afa Soran asked the Dr. Al-Wahidi about the characteristics of the shrapnel found in the injuries.
We have seen signs of penetration of shrapnel. Actually, we try to take some of these out.
We have seen sites of penetration of shrapnel. Actually, we tried to take some of these out, and we failed to find the other side of the shrapnel. We have examined all patients, and we did see that this shrapnel cannot be seen on the X-ray. That means that this is a type of shrapnel that we cannot see on the X-ray.
The recent Israeli invasion of Maghazi, along with the Friday killing of 4 family members, including children in Gaza City, are part of an Israeli military action codenamed Summer Rains, which in more than 3 weeks has claimed lives of over 150 Palestinians, wounded hundreds others, and caused widespread damage to Gaza's sole power plant, ministerial buildings, and bridges. For Afa Soran, this is Rami Al-Migari reporting from Gaza.
At this hour, the South Bay mobilization is wrapping up a demonstration at the federal building in San Jose to end civilian deaths in Iraq, Gaza, and Lebanon, with a focus on the failure of the U.S. to support a ceasefire in Lebanon. South Bay mobilization member Charlotte Casey.
40 people are here currently. We'll be expecting some more as obviously the people get off work and come over here to the rally.
That was Fadi Saba at the federal building. Member Charlotte Casey.
We're uniting the demands that U.S. stop supporting Israel in its invasion and attacks on Lebanon with the peace vigil that's been going on in front of the federal building for the last four and a half years, which has in general been aimed at stopping the U.S. invasion of Iraq, protesting the occupation, trying to end the war in Iraq. Now with the attacks and aggression by Israel against Lebanon, we're uniting those demands with the peace vigil demands.
Over 75 are currently at the rally. Fadi Saba says it's important that the U.S. Congress stop what he says is its support for all Israeli actions, regardless of whether they are in either country's long-term interests or not, and that Israeli military actions can only proceed with U.S. money.
Congress has no spine,
and neither does the president, to stand up against Israel, even though we're the ones, as taxpayers and as a country, give Israel $10 million a day, every day, 365 days a year, not a single vacation.
South Bay mobilization member Fadi Saba at today's protest in San Jose of the U.S.'s failure to support a ceasefire in Lebanon. Also at this time, the Peninsula Peace and Justice Center is conducting an emergency peace vigil in downtown Palo Alto this evening to call for U.S. support for an immediate ceasefire between Israel and Hezbollah militants. Director Paul George believes the White House is purposely and dangerously allowing the Israeli-Hezbollah conflict to fester.
The U.S. role in this is pretty clear. Having veto at the U.N. Security Council, where this crisis belongs, the U.S. can block any effort for a ceasefire, which is what Kofi Annan is calling for.
George added that the U.S. can single-handedly block the U.N. proposal for a ceasefire.
I would just encourage everyone to call the White House, call their congressional representatives, and tell them that they support an immediate ceasefire. Recent CNN poll said something like 60% of the American people support a ceasefire. We need to let our leaders know that that's what we want.
We spoke with Peninsula Peace and Justice Director Paul George just after the vigil began at 5 o'clock this evening.
Oh, there's just about 25 people here so far. We usually don't see most of the numbers until 5:30, quarter of 6. So people are just standing at the main intersection in downtown Palo Alto with signs that mostly say ceasefire now and the illegal occupation.
The Peninsula Peace and Justice Center peace vigil began at 5 o'clock this evening at Lytton Plaza on University Avenue and Emerson Street in downtown Palo Alto and continues until 6:30.
The Iraqi government announced yesterday that at least 162,000 people have fled their homes over the past 5 months in an effort to escape a rising tide of sectarian violence there. According to the United Nations, more than 100 Iraqis are dying every day in clashes. In Washington, Leanne Caldwell reports, Democratic lawmakers are pushing for a new debate on the U.S. occupation.
The public face of progress given by the administration on the war in Iraq has been tough to uphold this week. The United Nations revealed that 6,000 Iraqi citizens have been killed in the past 2 months. That's about 100 people per day. And Senate Democratic leader Harry Reid said yesterday that Iraq is engaged in a full-scale civil war. Democratic Representative John Murtha from Pennsylvania, a moderate Democrat who shocked many last year when he came out and called for a troop withdrawal of Iraq. He spoke this week once again about the war's consequences.
Because of the administration's policies in Iraq, our global diplomatic options are limited, and our international credibility, according to the polls, has been severely undermined. I believe the policy to continue to stay the course in Iraq is emboldened by our potential enemies. Who wants us in Iraq? North Korea, Iran, China, Russia, and Al-Qaeda. Because they believe as a nation we are distracted. As a world superpower, we're depleting our resources.
But Democrats criticizing the administration wouldn't seem to them as harmful, just partisan politics. But Democrats aren't the only ones voicing discern. Representative Gil Gutnick, Republican from Minnesota, has been a staunch supporter of the war. He wanted to stay the course. Until he returned from Iraq last week. He told a local Minnesota newspaper that Iraq is a serious problem and that the administration has been painting a rosy picture of the war that is indeed inaccurate. He said the troops should begin to redeploy. White House Press Secretary Tony Snow's reaction.
We also disagree with him. He's expressing his opinion.
Senator John Thune from South Dakota, who is serving his first term, partially because of heavy campaigning by President Bush, told an audience at the National Press Club on Wednesday that if he was running for re-election, he would not embrace the president or his agenda, especially on the war in Iraq. He also said, quote, "The first thing I do is acknowledge that there have been mistakes made." And Representative Jim Gerlach, Republican from Pennsylvania, acknowledging the trouble in Iraq, proposed legislation that would set goals or progress markers. Adding to Iraq's woes, the Government Accountability Office released a report this week on the cost estimates. John Walker, Comptroller General of the GAO, says $430 billion have been allocated, but neither Congress nor the Department of Defense really knows how much the war is costing and how much has been spent. That's because some aspects aren't being taken into account.
The Veterans Administration, who is taking care of our wounded, there are disability costs associated with that. You know, we're losing a lot of equipment that's being damaged, that's being destroyed, if you will. Plus, let's face it, we're running huge deficits, and we're having to borrow to fund these costs, and therefore we're going to be paying interest on this as well.
But a majority of Congress still seems to support the war. With the most recent bad news, Democratic leader Harry Reid wants to debate the war again in the Senate. The Senate did that just last month. They voted on three resolutions. But the only resolution setting a timeline for troop withdrawal received the support of just 13. The House of Representatives debated the war last month as well. They passed a resolution 256 to 153 that said the U.S. will prevail in the war on terror. Next week, Iraqi Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki will visit Washington and address Congress. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Leon Caldwell.
Four U.S. soldiers accused of murdering suspected Iraqi resistance fighters during a May 9th raid say their orders were to kill all military-aged males. One of the accused, Staff Sergeant Raymond Gerard, said the rule of engagement was to kill all military-age males on the mission. The soldiers said they took the men into custody because they were using two women and a baby as human shields. After the women and child were safe, the soldiers said that the men attacked them and three were shot in self-defense. The raid targeted a small island in a canal in the northern Salahuddin province where U.S. officials say Iraqi fighters affiliated with al-Qaeda were holed up. An attorney for the soldiers said that a few AK-47 assault rifles and some ammunition found nearby proved that the men were a threat. By law in Iraq, every home is allowed one AK-47 rifle and a small amount of ammunition for protection. The four soldiers have been jailed on a U.S. military base in Kuwait since being arrested in June and are awaiting their first hearing scheduled for August 1st in Tikrit, Iraq.
Two former Pentagon officials, including an acting Secretary of the Navy, have reportedly been accused of scheming with a banned American contractor to get lucrative rebuilding contracts in Iraq. The military suspended the contracting firm Custer Battles LLC 2 years ago for submitting millions of dollars in fake invoices. The charges come in a sealed federal lawsuit, a copy of which was obtained by the Associated Press. It was filed by two whistleblowers, one of whom won a $10 million judgment in another suit when a federal jury agreed that Custer Battles had swindled the government. The new suit contends Custer Battles, both Army veterans with Washington political connections, tried to get around the suspension order by plotting with Johnson and Combs Company to set up sham companies, thereby concealing their ownership and control of those entities. This is the KPFA Evening News on 94.1 FM and KPFA.org. This newscast airs each night at 6 o'clock. Still to come, animal rights activists hold a national call-in day to pressure Andronikos to contract with more humane egg producers. And the California Department of Insurance passed new regulations last Friday to enforce Proposition 103, but insurance companies have filed a lawsuit to stop the rules from taking effect. With Glenn Reeder, I'm Sandra Lupien. A San Francisco independent journalist faces federal imprisonment for refusing to comply with a federal grand jury. The grand jury is demanding he disclose an unedited videotape of a protest in San Francisco last year where a police car was allegedly burned. KPFA's Christina Onestad reports.
Josh Wolf says it is his constitutional right not to disclose his unpublished materials or his sources. Wolf faces up to 18 months in prison for refusing to hand over video footage of last year's G8 protest in San Francisco to a federal grand jury. Wolf says he's ready to go to jail to defend his constitutional rights.
I am prepared to go to jail if I am found in contempt. It is the First Amendment rights of a journalist to be able to protect their unpublished material. Otherwise, this trust relationship, which is essential to the practices of journalism, it's just not possible. And without that trust, without the ability to practice journalism, then do you really still have a democracy?
The federal grand jury is investigating an alleged burning of a police car during last year's G8 protest in San Francisco, where a police officer was also hospitalized. Attorneys for Josh Wolf say vandalism of a police car is a state matter, not a federal matter. But prosecutors say it is a federal matter because the police receive federal dollars. Wolf's attorneys say federal prosecutors are working with local police to crack down on political dissidents. Carlos Villarreal, executive director for the National Lawyers Guild in San Francisco, says the case against Josh Wolf is important for press freedom.
It is about a free and independent media. It is about a Justice Department that has no respect for justice and an executive branch that tries to convince us that the only way to preserve freedom is for us to enjoy less and less of it. It is about taking the free and independent media and turning it into an arm of the government as opposed to a check of and balance to the government.
According to Villarreal, arguments over Wolf's First Amendment rights weren't disputed, but the judge was interested in hearing arguments over Wolf's Fifth Amendment rights of self-incrimination. Wolf says his videotape doesn't have the information the grand jury is looking for.
If you watch my published video from the G8 Solidarity protest from July 8th of last year, you will hear an unidentified officer shouting to the crowd, "Leave, or you're going to be f***ing blasted. I'm a fed motherfucker." As an independent journalist, I am protected by the California Shield Law from having to disclose my unpublished material. However, there is no federal shield law that protects journalists, and the government is exploiting this fact by circumventing state law through the use of the federal grand jury. If the federal government can trump these state protections in the case of the alleged vandalism of an SFPD police car, a city police car, then what other state policies might be trampled by this broad interpretation of the law?
The Grand Jury Resistance Project said that within the past 2 years, grand juries have been used to suppress and incarcerate over 60 activists in the Northwest. San Francisco supervisors Ross Mercurimi and Chris Daly have proposed local legislation condemning what they say is federal grand jury interference in a local investigation. The board is expected to vote on it next week. Wolf's next hearing for refusing to comply with a grand jury will be on August 1st. Reporting for KPFA News in San Francisco, I'm Christina Onnested.
Less than a week after the United Nations Security Council unanimously adopted a resolution condemning North Korea for test launching several ballistic missiles, the United States has launched an unarmed Minuteman III intercontinental ballistic missile from Vandenberg Air Force Base in California. The missile, carrying three dummy bombs, was fired 4,200 miles across the Pacific toward the missile test range at Kwajalein Atoll in the Marshall Islands with a flight time of 30 minutes, intended to test the reliability and capability of the missile system. The test is the latest in an ongoing series of regularly scheduled ballistic missile tests conducted by the U.S. military. Using a report by former U.N. weapons inspector Hans Blix, Jackie Cabasso with the Western States Legal Foundation in Oakland believes the missile test will not make the U.S. more secure.
I would argue that U.S. Ongoing development of long-range precise delivery systems that are capable of carrying either nuclear or conventional warheads actually is making the United States less safe, less secure over time for a number of different reasons. For one thing, do as we say, not as we do, is simply not a sustainable policy over the long term. And that's been recently recognized and affirmed by the Hans Blix-led Weapons of Mass Destruction Commission, which found that the best way to increase international security is for countries to feel individually more secure, and you do not increase their sense of security by threatening it with your own weapons of mass destruction, which is what the United States is doing with countries around the world.
Cabasso says the U.S. reliance on more threatening weapons and more efficient delivery systems while simultaneously insisting that its perceived enemies not do likewise increases the danger to everyone.
Unless we stop bombing and start talking, if I might put it into a slogan, I think it's going to continue to serve as an incentive to those countries to want to seek their own nuclear weapons and delivery systems, which makes the whole world less secure while the United States goes on lobbying its long-range missiles and developing new military capabilities.
The U.S. maintains a nuclear arsenal of over 10,000 warheads and is upgrading its delivery systems in pursuit of a so-called prompt global strike capability.
More than 40,000 California high school seniors did not pass the California High School Exit Exam on time to graduate with their fellow members of the class of 2006. State officials said an additional 1,759 seniors did pass the exit exam in the last administration of the test before the end of the school year. The students who passed the test in May bring the pass rate to about 91% for the two-part English and math test. That's according to the State Department of Education. The exam was required for the first time this year to receive a California diploma. The legislature approved the controversial exit exam requirement in 1999, but its implementation was delayed several years because of challenges and lawsuits. A group of English learning students who failed the test sued to block the results so they could graduate, arguing it was discriminatory because all California students do not have equal preparation or instruction. They won a temporary injunction in May, and the exam was nearly waived again this year before the state Supreme Court intervened. A state appeals court is expected to hear arguments in the case Tuesday in San Francisco.
The California Department of Insurance passed new regulations last Friday to enforce Proposition 103, but insurance companies have filed a lawsuit to stop the rules from taking effect. Africa Jones reports.
Three auto insurance company groups filed a lawsuit on Wednesday to halt new regulations the California Department of Insurance enacted last week. The rules force insurance companies to base auto premiums on the driving record of the driver as opposed to where the driver lives. Jerry Davies, Director of Communications of the Personal Insurance Federation of California, one of the plaintiffs in the suit, says that the regulations would penalize rural drivers in favor of urban drivers.
We tried to express to the commissioner via statistics, studies, as well as testimony, that if these regulations as proposed go forward, it's going to mean rate increases for the millions of rural and suburban drivers, and these drivers in the rural areas will now have to subsidize the actual insurance that's paid for by the urban drivers.
Last Friday, the California Department of Insurance approved new regulations by California Insurance Commissioner John Garamendi. Garamendi says the new rules are only enforcing the will of the people.
The insurance industry, as is their custom, and as they have been doing for 18 years, is doing everything they possibly can to stand in the way of the will of the voters of California. What we're seeing here is the last dying gasps of an industry that has fought for 18 years to stand in front of the voters and tell them, no, 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 we won't do it your way. Proposition 103 says that auto insurance ought to be based principally on your driving record, how safely you drive, secondly, on the miles you drive each year, and thirdly, on your experience behind the wheel. So this system was never put in place. Chuck Quackenbush, the disgraced insurance commissioner who was bought and paid for by the insurance industry, wrote regulations that allowed the industry to continue its very, very unfair and frankly very discriminatory zip code redlining. And that's going to stop. My regulations put a stop to that.
Doug Heller with the Foundation for Taxpayer and Consumer Rights says the regulations mean that rates for most drivers will go down.
These new rules are not going to force premiums up for good drivers in California. And in fact, we have the proof because just last week, Auto Club of Southern California, that's the AAA, made an announcement that they were going to comply with Commissioner Garamendi's rules. They were going to reform their system and lower their rates. So 88% of their drivers will be seeing an average of $134 rate decrease. So when the insurance companies tell us that rates are going to go up when they comply with these rules, that's just bogus. Rates will go down if you're a good driver.
Jerry Davies of the Personal Insurance Federation of California disagrees.
Mr. Heller has never understood this. The cost for an insurance company to write insurance in Los Angeles and pay for the great number of accidents in the congested area are quite high, and they are much, much higher than the cost for the Inyo County driver. But if you're going to force them to lower the actual rates in the large urban areas where Mr. Heller lives, he's going to force the drivers in the rural counties where they pay much less because the costs are less, they're going to have to literally subsidize those rates.
John Garamendi says that price discrimination in the insurance industry is widespread.
The fact of the matter is that there is gross discrimination in the urban areas. If you live in the zip code to the west of Broadway in the Oakland area, you will pay twice as much as if you live on the east side of Broadway, just on the other side of the street. Now, those people are driving the same cars in the same communities in the same roads, and yet one community will pay higher than the other community.
The new regulations are scheduled to take effect next month. For KPFA News, I'm Africa Jones.
Three employees at a youth prison in Stockton were disciplined after the suicide last year of an 18-year-old who was isolated in his room there for 2 months. The California prison system made the revelation today in a preliminary response to a public records request from the Associated Press. In a report that was previously released, the prison system's inspector general blamed poor oversight for Joseph Daniel Maldonado's August 31st suicide at the Chaderjian Youth Correctional Facility. Employees failed to allow Maldonado counseling, visitors, or exercise, and missed several signs that he needed mental health treatment, said the December report by Inspector General Matthew Cate. After employees discovered Maldonado had covered his windows and was not responding, they took 38 minutes to enter the teen's room. They found Maldonado hanging from a bedsheet. Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation spokesperson Julio Calderon said today three employees were disciplined in the Maldonado case, but he could not disclose what the actions were because, he said, it is a personnel matter. The number of disciplinary actions was released after more than 7 months of request for information and a Public Records Act request filed by the Associated Press June 9th. Critics, including the organization Books Not Bars, have called for closing youth prisons like Chaderjian. Instead, the department last week said it will turn Chaderjian into a specialized treatment facility for sexual offenders and those with substance abuse or mental health problems. The suicides of two wards at a different facility in January 2004 helped trigger investigations into the way California treats its young people who are incarcerated.
Animal rights activists held a national call-in day to pressure Andronico's supermarket chain to improve its humane standards. The day of action was organized by East Bay Animal Advocates. Wendell Harper reports.
From elephants to chickens, from fowl to shelled eggs, animal rights advocates are on the march, confronting grocery chains, SPCAs, the government, or whomever about their perception of animals being abused primarily for money. Even the band Goldfinger caught up in the protest.
So free me. I just want to feel what life should be. I just want enough space to turn around. So free me. When are you gonna realize you're just wrong? You can't even think for yourself, can't even make up your minds. So my mind's a jail, I hate the whole damn human race. What the hell do you want from me? Kill me if you just don't know, or free me. I just want to feel what life should be.
Shockingly, Andronico still sells eggs from chickens confined in battery cages, says animal rights activist Christine Morrison, as the organization says it recently documented conditions at Andronico's brand name egg supplier, Nucal Foods Incorporated.
Andronico's stores, which there's 10 stores throughout the Bay Area, sells eggs from hens that are confined to battery cages, which is an extremely cruel practice in egg production.
What are battery cages? This is how Australian Community Radio describes them.
Half of all chicks born are male and are killed at 1 day old. They are crushed or gassed. Debeaking is a mutilation involving partial amputation of the beak with a red-hot blade. This is to prevent cannibalism due to behavioral deprivation and lack of space. The mutilation of debeaking causes chronic pain. Caged hens are denied all behavioral needs, such as wing stretching, nesting, walking, perching, preening, and dust bathing. Her worst torture is an inability to lay her eggs in privacy. It is an overwhelming urge. In battery cages, these birds are spent at around 1 year and are killed for soups, stock, baby food, convenience. Battery hens suffer feather loss, foot and leg injuries, bone weaknesses, and skin abrasions.
During a Fly on the Wall feature on Australian Community Radio, they talk about the notion of battery-caged hens, dolphins, etc.
You see, I saw this ad on TV the other day. It was from the RSPCA talking about battery hens. You know, the ones that lay eggs and how they're kept in tiny cages all their life?
Yeah, so?
Well, what if there were rows and rows of dolphins in cages?
Dolphins live underwater, remember?
Well, underwater cages then. But that's not the point.
Oh, what is the point?
I don't know, I've just been thinking, that's all. It's a bit weird. Some animals are revered and another animal is killed for food. Just can't really see that there's any reason to treat them differently.
Yeah.
As far as animal rights activists are concerned, whether grocery chain or otherwise, there's little public concern about the problem of animal abuse. Or so says John Feldman of the Goldfinger Band. He says activists are divided into categories that leave them mistaken for terrorists in too many cases.
I guess it depends on what you're doing. You know, if you're being a vegetarian and eating a veggie burger, you know, that's one thing. Or if you're getting in people's faces with a bullhorn, that's something else as well. The thing is, lately, the ELF, the Earth Liberation Front, has been burning down apartment complexes and burning down these SUVs, the Hummer trucks and stuff. You know, that kind of stuff. So they're trying to tie in the Animal Liberation Front with some of these people. And any kind of arson, that's always been a huge crime, no matter how you break it down and look at it. So, I mean, they're trying to see if there was any connection with me and these other actions, which obviously there isn't. Because I don't break the law, you know what I mean? And if I break the law, I'm in jail. How many kids are going to read Why Vegans at one of our concerts if I'm, you know, stuck in jail right now, you know what I mean?
Several retailers, including Whole Foods Market, Wild Oats Natural Marketplace, and others already have adopted policies to carry only cage-free eggs, says Christine Morrison, in order to advance the company's commitment to excellence. She says Andronico's should be pressured by writers, callers, and petitioners to adopt a cage-free egg policy.
And we're holding this national call-in today to get folks around the Bay Area and around the nation to let Andronico's know that they don't want Andronico's to be selling these types of eggs. And instead that we want Andronico's to adopt a cage-free egg policy throughout their 10 stores in the Bay Area.
So I guess there must not be much oversight or enforcement.
Yeah, there's zero enforcement of this cruelty code in relation to chickens and egg production.
And who's responsible for that enforcement?
It would be local animal control agencies and the state food and ag department.
And they've been contacted but have done what?
They've been contacted, but nothing has been done on their part.
Wendell Harper reporting for KPFA News.
The U.S. Agriculture Department has announced it will dramatically scale back testing for mad cow disease. Matt Kay has more from Washington.
Agriculture Secretary Mike Johann says years of normal and expanded testing shows the U.S. likely has just a handful of infected animals, with just three confirmed so far, and reducing mad cow testing by almost 90% to 40,000 a year is still well above international guidelines. Johann dismisses arguments by consumer interests. The move raises new safety concerns for the U.S. beef supply.
Those who are attempting to cause consumers to believe that somehow they're protected by testing really aren't being fair with consumers. The way to protect consumers is to remove the specified risk materials to deal with the issue directly.
Brain and spinal tissues in food and animal feed are thought to spread the brain wasting disease, but key former U.S. beef market Japan has urged continued expanded U.S. testing, though Tokyo officials say the latest move will likely have no impact on Japan's expected decision soon to reopen to American beef. In Washington, Matt Kay for Free Speech Radio News.
North Carolina's State Licensing Board for Doctors gave initial approval today for a policy blocking doctors from actively participating in executions, addressing an ethical issue facing doctors and nurses in many states. The North Carolina Medical Board is expected to make a final vote on the proposed policy in 2 or 3 months after receiving comments. Under the proposed policy, quote, physician participation in capital punishment is a departure from the ethics of the medical profession. North Carolina state law requires a doctor to be present at executions, but the proposal, which the board approved unanimously, prohibits physicians from doing anything but observe. The proposed policy is less strict than the stance of the American Medical Association, which equates the presence of a doctor with participation. A California lethal injection was stayed earlier this year pending judicial review. A federal judge had ordered a doctor to be present for the lethal injection of Michael Morales after Morales' attorneys argued that lethal injection could cause Morales to succumb to excruciating pain after the administration of a second of three drugs. Two doctors agreed to be present, but later backed out when they realized they'd have to intervene if they observed Morales to be in pain. In response, the judge stayed the execution until he's able to review lethal injection protocols.
The Ugandan government has proposed imposing sanctions on Burundi's last remaining rebel group, the National Liberation Forces, to force them to lay down their arms. As FSRN's Emmanuel Okella reports, the rebel group has ignored calls to join the peace process that has ended the war between the main Hutu rebels and the national army led by the Tutsi minority.
South African Security Minister Charles Nkwakula was in Uganda this week to brief President Museveni on the progress of the Burundi peace process. He said the latest demands by the rebels for the disbandment of the Burundi army is not realistic and has been rejected by the Burundi government. He told reporters in Kampala that he had to come to Uganda to brief President Museveni for the regional peace initiative in Burundi to decide on the way forward.
There are things that now and again become sticking points, but the main one always revolves around the army. The feeling on the part of Palipe Hutu FNL is that however you look at the history and origin of the conflict in Burundi, you will find a role that was played by the army in exacerbating that conflict. And therefore, most of their demands relate to the army. The first demand was that the army had to be dismantled and a new army built from scratch. They understand now that it's not possible to do that, but they are still insisting that you need fundamentally to transform that army.
Since gaining independence in 1962, Burundi's history has been characterized by repressive military dictatorships and violent conflict between the country's Hutu and Tutsi ethnic groups. The rebellions were largely halted with the signing of the Arusha Peace Accord in 2000. The FNL rebels have continuously rejected an offer of peace talks with the Burundi government. Army reform remains the most contentious issue. The Burundi army was Tutsi dominated over the majority Hutu. The FNL demands that the army be disbanded and reconstituted to reflect the country's ethnic balance, while the government wants FNL fighters integrated into the current army. According to Uganda's Foreign Affairs Minister Sam Kutesa, countries in the Great Lakes region are growing impatient with the FNL rebels for continuing to delay the full implementation of the Burundi peace process.
The region did exert pressure on parties which were a bit recalcitrant about concluding these negotiations. And I think similar pressure will be exerted on FNL Parvahutu if they just drag on and on and on. Because I think there ought to be pressure exerted on any party that is foot dragging. There are sanctions, travel restrictions, there are diplomatic, or even whether it is on a rebel group or even a government that is becoming a problem, there are sanctions that the region can impose. And I think that nobody would want to submit those sanctions.
Under the Arusha Peace and Reconciliation Accord of August 2000, the army was to share power equally between Hutus and Tutsis. With the peace deal reached in November 2003, combatants from former rebel movements, the majority Hutus, were integrated in the army, breaking the tradition of a Tutsi-dominated army. For Free Speech Radio News, Emmanuel Okella, reporting from Kampala, Uganda.
The weather forecast for the San Francisco Bay Area tonight, it'll be mostly clear with lows in the lower to mid-60s. Tomorrow it'll be mostly sunny, highs in the mid-80s, up into the hundreds inland. Record high temperatures are possible tomorrow and Sunday. For Fresno and the central San Joaquin Valley, a heat advisory is in effect until 9 in the evening on Sunday. Tonight it'll be partly cloudy with a 20% chance of thunderstorms, then mostly clear after midnight, lows 72 to 82. Tomorrow mostly sunny, highs 105 to 101. That's it for the news tonight. Thanks for tuning in. Stay tuned for special coverage of the escalating crisis in the Middle East, hosted by members of the Flashpoints crew and Voices of the Middle East. That's immediately following this newscast. And thanks to Mick Mylan, who produced recorded portions of the broadcast and is at the controls. With Glenn Reeder, I'm Sandra Lupien. Good evening.
this week in the community calendar. Volunteer for the Richmond Emirate AIDS Foundation Help Is On The Way Gala event and do your part for AIDS awareness. Help set up on Saturday, July 29th from 9 a.m. to 1 p.m. at the Nob Hill Masonic Center, 1111 California Street in San Francisco. Go to the worldwideweb.onebrick.org for more information. This event is wheelchair accessible. The community calendar is produced by members of the KPFA First Voice Apprenticeship Program.
You're listening to KPFA, KPFB, Berkeley, KFCF, Fresno, or online at kpfa.org. Up next, we have special programming on Israel's expanding attacks in Lebanon.